Do you know about all the musical genres that were created by black musicians? Like jazz, rock and roll, and folk music, to name a few. This Black Music Month, State Farm is celebrating the cultural impact and influence of music created and inspired by black innovators. Next time you're enjoying a song, trace it back to its origins and see for yourself. Check out the Black Music Forever station on Pandora, brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
When you find a deal on your favorite thing in the McDonald's app and order it, does that technically count as online shopping? Save money with the app. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's, prices may vary.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. And my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, Amazon Prime, all the places.
I am Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. And I'm currently fundraising for my third, Best Friends Forever. I am a distribution consultant and I used to work at Sundance.
On this Thursday bonus episode, we're going to play the interview from episode 269 from June 2020 with director Bruce McDonald, who talks about his filmmaking career and making his latest film at the time, Dreamland. I thought this was a good match for Matt because they are both true artists. Like, they're very artsy-fartsy people in the best way. Bruce was even willing to, like, connect me to other artists that he's worked with. He, like, was trying to help me find, like, a composer for my film at the time. And he was just really open and really cool guy. And I just really thought that, like, the way that he has lived his life as a filmmaker seems similar to the way that Matt is living his life as a filmmaker and an artist. You know, they kind of just seem to both just be doing their thing. So indie, so out in the world, just like not really caring what other people think about their work and just keep on making movies, which, you know, I mean, Bruce is like 80 credits as a director at this point in his career. So I feel like Matt, you know, could be racking up the same amount of producer credits if he just keeps going. After that, we play another round of Y'all the Expert. But first, don't forget to check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/mmihpodcast. This is the way the show will continue to thrive and live and grow. It's the way that our editor, Jeff Reinmuth, gets paid for his editing, which is essential. So thank you all who are supporting us on Patreon. You guys are amazing. Also, don't forget to leave us a review on or a rating on Apple Podcasts, which is a great way to expand the show and keep people coming in and finding us and all that good stuff. But without any more further bibble babble, here's our throwback interview with Bruce McDonald. All right. So first question, Bruce, is how many days did you shoot on Dreamland?
33 days.
Ooh. And what was the rough budget, if you're allowed to talk about that?
It's under $100 million, but it's probably closer to five.
Okay. How long did you work on the film from inception to it being released?
I don't know. I mean, when we started it after we made Pontypool, we started the writing and we finished it, you know, last year. So
wow.
Do the math. But, you know, that's like a couple of years off and doing other things. So you kind of chip away at something. It's like building a birdhouse or something.
How many people were on set for this one?
The shooting crew was probably about 24 people.
And then out of all your projects, how difficult was this one?
This was dreamy for Dreamland. It was fun. And did we have any nightmares? Not really. We were in Europe. We drank a lot of wine. We worked with fantastic people. The hours weren't long. They were like, in Europe, they shoot for 8 hours. They have an hour to set up, an hour, and 8 hours to shoot, and an hour to tear it down. Very civilized, shot mostly days. So evenings were for dining and prepping and bonding. Yeah, it was great. It was, so I'd say on the easy factor, it wasn't easy, nothing, but it wasn't painful. There was no pain in this one.
What part of Europe were you shooting in?
We shot in Luxembourg City, and then we shot in a place called Charleroi, which is in Belgium. It's kind of the Detroit of Belgium. It's a kind of an old industrial city that's fallen on hard times. So it was beautiful locations.
So you started writing this. It sounds like we don't want to say the exact date because it's been a while. What inspired Dreamland?
Well, it's funny, you know, because I think if I had to just say the first thing that came to my head, it would be working with Tony and Steven and Lisa. That was sort of the big inspiration. That was I don't know if you know this film, but it was a film starring Steven and Lisa. It's sort of a sci-fi. It's about a language virus. Anyway, we finished that and we thought, wow, we should keep going. And the original ending for Pontypool was Steven and Lisa, the two stars from Pontypool. He was dressed as a gangster. She was dressed as a mall. His name was Johnny Deadeyes and hers was Lisa the Killer. And they have this weird conversation. It's in the movie, but it's at the end of the credits because the producers thought it was so weird. That's where it was sort of born from, I suppose. Plus the impulse to like, hey, let's keep the band together. And then plus, there was a short film that McCaddy made where he plays Chet Baker. It was called The Deaths of Chet Baker, and it's by a director named Robert Boudreau, who went on to make a film called Born to be Blue, which is about Chet Baker, starring Ethan Hawke, which Steven plays Chet's dad. So it's all very sort of connected. But, you know, it's not unusual for things to take a long time.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I've heard a lot about Pontypool because I told you earlier, like I went to Toronto and there was a Stephen McCaddy movie playing at this film festival I was at, and everybody was like a buzz about Pontypool and this you know, awesome indie genre film. So, you know, it's really kind of interesting to hear that this is sort of connected to that film in a way. It's not, doesn't really sound like it's a sequel, but it's sort of like inspired by, kind of. Sounds
it's
like
kind of like the freak baby of Pontypool. Chet Baker and Pontypool had a baby together, and it was a little freak baby named Dreamland. So I think that's the best way to... So it's definitely a parent, Pontypool. Most definitely the mother or the father.
And then, you know, as a director, like, you're not credited as the writer of this film, but, like, how involved are you in this, the shaping of the story? Like, are you, do you have meetings with the writer and talk about story breakdowns and beats? Or?
Yes. It just goes on. And, I mean, Tony's a genius and he's really fun, but he doesn't really care too much for structure. I mean, he does, but he doesn't. So, yes, I'm not a writer myself, but I, you know, most of the indie films that we've done, I've worked with writers from the beginning stages, and I'm kind of the first audience, and I like to be involved because I know that if I'm going to shoot it, I got to know how much it costs, and you know, it's really a pleasure. It's a privilege to be involved in the early stages because it's kind of that's where you're planning the campaign, and Tony and I have become very good pals, so it's really fun to meet up and he uses me as a sounding board or what about this or what about that. And then we would bring it to Steven because from the beginning we knew that we were writing for Steven McCaddy. Like it wasn't, let's write the script and then go find the cast. It was like, no, he's going to be the guy. So it was really great that Tony and I then would go over to Steve's place, who Lisa is his gal, and we would present them with the new draft and they'd have something to say. So it was really a great way to do it, especially because it's such a nutty movie that it really was kind of a head scratcher at times of how to not make sense but still make sense.
Right, how to keep us guessing and in the dream state while also telling a story with a, like, you know, cohesive thread to it.
Yeah, it's a really weird. So that was a lot of weird math. So it was. I mean, it was fun, but it was a tricky thing because I guess, you know, the impulse was to try to stay true to Tony's very strange and slight, you know, surrealistic kind of impulses and be in that sort of dream state and not logic it up a little bit. And it's tough in movies because movies, you know, there's such a lot of moving parts and there's a lot of money, you know, to me, anything over $100 is a lot of money. So, you know, you're dealing with people that are asking questions like, why is there two guys? And why is there a vampire? Why is it, blah, blah, blah. So
what's your answer when people ask those questions that, that maybe you don't want to answer?
I say, it's in Dreamland. It's a dream. That's the shortest answer. But then if I'm really feeling fancy, I'll dig into William Burroughs' Naked Lunch, or I'll dig into you know, French surrealists, or I'll dig into, it's a good question you asked, because at one point I was getting these questions, and sometimes I think I knew what I was talking about, but other times I didn't. There's a Peter Steeves, he's a philosopher, head of the philosophy department in Chicago, and he was a big fan of Pontypool. So he brought us there one day and presented this big paper, philosophical paper on, you know, so then I would, and I, so after that, I said, Peter, we're making a new film with Steven and Tony. Would you consider coming on board as the production philosopher? So we could, if we have questions like, why are there two guys? Maybe you could help us answer that. And he was like, oh yeah. So he was great. Like, he didn't get to come to set because we were pretty far away, but he, you know, he wrote me some stuff about, you know, the history of the doppelganger and kind of what it sort of means in literature and in philosophy. I should pull out the paper. I don't have it right off the top of my head, but right here. But it was fun, you know, for such a crazy, it was kind of like having a shrink. You know, you go in and Peter's the doctor and you lie down and you talk to him about vampires and, you know, anyway, so he was quite delighted. So now I think from now on, I'm going to have a production philosopher in every movie.
Did you use that kind of source when talking to actors? Like, I find that very often, I mean, you're very respected and very experienced in the film industry. So I doubt you have any actors questioning your methods or questioning the script.
All the time, yes. Or not, you know they're always asking questions. So sorry to interrupt.
No, that's good to know too. But I guess I'm just curious, like, when you want to just have that open mind and that open flow of logic through the storyline, and there may not always be a concrete motivation for the actor, do you pull in that production philosopher and say, we'll talk to him? He has a whole, you know, thesis.
I did that a couple times, you know, I think with and encourage them. You know, we would talk, and sometimes, you know, when it get onto the deep waters of semiotics and French surrealism and doppelgangers and that sort of thing, I'm good to a point. And then I said, well, there's this guy, you know, the production philosopher, he would love to talk to you. So I think Lisa, Steven, maybe a couple others, kind of like we'd email him and then he'd email back, but he was delighted to be sort of part of the process. Because it's a funny thing, writing and the writing, you know, one of the things you want to ask yourself at the very beginning of any project is, well, what's the theme, or what's the impulse? And philosophy is something that's always been there to help us answer those big questions. You know, where do I come from, and where is my, you know, who am I? It's these sorts of things. So when you're creating a new world, like a movie, and especially in this case, a movie that doesn't make any sense, those sort of philosophical questions and dream states are quite curious, and that, you know, you can sometimes get lost in the labyrinth, but often, you know, you'll pick up a thread and you'll either be validated in your impulses to think, oh, okay, there's a tradition of this, and, you know, and off you go.
So you said, you know, you've mentioned a few times how this movie is pretty out there and different. Was there any, like, one thing that you were getting a lot of pushback from investors or producers that you fought for that ended up in the movie?
Yeah, I think the two things were, why is there a vampire, and why is there two guys that look the same? And weirdly, the guys that asked about the vampire, they love the fact that there was a vampire in it. I'm talking about the producers and the money, because I guess they thought, if there's a vampire in a movie, maybe it's a horror movie. And, you know, we don't quite know what it is, if it's a horror movie. I mean, it could be, I suppose, but not really. So they kind of liked the kind of commercial idea of a vampire, but they weren't sure what it was doing in our movie. So I just kind of assured them that, you know, this was a modern fairy tale that we were making. And this was, you know, an allegory about the current times, and this is the world, about a world above and a world below, and you know, and then you know, if again, getting right back, it's, and I would say it's called Dreamland, so there's a vampire, and but they, you know, you did get those questions, and nobody was out to sort of stop it, but they did have the questions, and they kind of, even the money and even the guys and the women that were up in the in that kind of rational, you know, in the control room with the levers of rationality, they seemed to kind of enjoy the fact that there were these sort of strange elements. And perhaps if the world that we made wrapped its arms around these, it would all seem to, they would all seem to belong with each other, would all seem intentional and motivated.
I have a big grin on my face right now. I'm a big fan of David Lynch. Like, my dog's name is Laura Palmer. So
that's hilarious.
Like well, dream logic.
I adore David Lynch, yes.
I love dream logic. I love the idea of driving creativity from, you know, different aspects of consciousness that you might not be even aware of. Can you talk a little bit about the creative process for this film? I know you didn't write it, but you worked with the writer, and were there like atypical things that you did on set? Anything about how you created this open atmosphere?
Well, it's funny you mentioned David Lynch, you know, because, you know, he has this great book called Catching the Big Fish, mm-hmm, and he talks about transcendental meditation and stuff. And I don't know much about that particular meditation practice, but I was really fascinated to read that he'd been a student of this. And, you know, the short takeaway from me that I got from this book that he wrote, and of course the films, I adore his movies, is that, you know, you keep, if you keep a door open to the unconscious and don't regulate it too much, you know, cinema is a dream. You know, cinema is I always look at TV as kind of like theater and logic and books and novels and talking and people and great stories, whereas movies sort of have a bit more or maybe in the future they'll continue to kind of explore that path of big of cinema, sound, picture, dreamy things, and moving sound, picture, image things, and be sort of liberated from the kind of fascism of kind of narrative logic, which is really pleasurable. But when you get into Lynch territory, there's something just fantastic about, not that anything is allowed, because even his films, there's a certain logic to the illogicalness to it. So I guess, you know, going into this in this process, what I decided to do was to try to keep that door open. And when I, you know, film is a very collaborative thing, so the DP and the designer and the costume people, I would encourage them. I would say, listen, you know, like sometimes, you know, if you keep that door open, it's called Dreamland. If you have an impulse that you're not quite sure of, please tell me. You know, before you decide it's not a good idea or a bad idea, just tell me if there's an impulse. So people sort of thought, okay, and they would start to do that. And they would, for instance, you know, the designer came to me one day, the costume person, she says, well, we've got this kid gang. And, you know, I was just thinking of what they might wear. And in my mind, I'm thinking they're wearing hoodies and, you know, tough little Oakland fucking bad boys, you know. And she was like, well, what if they wore little black suits with ties? And, you know, and I was like, I don't know exactly why it would be, but why not? And so a lot of those decisions that you see in the film, a number of them actually, from sometimes in the casting, sometimes in the choice of location or the choice of, you know, this or that, was sort of, you know, impulses or to try to, you know, to try to just keep the dream. Like, why does Hercules have two women dressed as little soldiers? And as is kind of, they were written to be kind of like a couple of New Jersey Goombas. But we thought, well, maybe there are these two beautiful women in soldier outfits, sort of. And like, so it was that sort of playfulness that was really fun. And we were all given permission, you know, from the cinematographer and the play with color and different things, because we were trying to capture a dream. So we didn't want a logic. So the lesson, I guess the method was to not try to explain things, I guess, because there's, whenever you delve into sort of supernatural world a little bit, I mean, you need rules, but the minute somebody starts to explain how the spaceship got to Earth, you just fall asleep, right? It's sort of like, yeah. Oh God, this is the worst part of the movie. So we thought, well, let's keep the explanation out and try to keep the impulse in.
So I'm just curious about like how this movie came to be made, because you mentioned that you were working on it for like 10 years or so. Why were you able to make it now? And like, what were the circumstances that allowed you guys to get it shot?
Well, it's funny, you know, because when we were writing the script, and it wasn't, you know, when you say 10 years, it sounds like a shocking amount of time, but really it's like, you know, years would go by, we wouldn't do anything, and we, I wonder what's going on with Dreamland, let's get together. But it's a movie when we were writing, we had a lot of fun doing it, and in some ways, I don't think we ever thought we would ever make it. Like, it was just, you know, I would go away from our session, my session with Tony, or getting together with Steve and Lisa, and walk away and thinking, yeah, this is really fun, but I don't think anybody in their right mind is ever going to let us do this, because it's just, it doesn't make, you know, it's just sort of, it's not this or it's not. It's, everything is sort of wrong about it. Through a series of circumstances, I guess the savior of the movie, or the person that kind of turned the key, is Jesus of Luxembourg. Now, his actual name is pronounced Jesus because he's Spanish, but he lives in Luxembourg. So we affectionately refer to him as Jesus of Luxembourg. And somehow he came across the script. There was a company in Los Angeles called Shoreline or Lakeshore. Yeah. Morris Ruskin, really lovely guy. He kind of connected the things. He connected the dots. And suddenly Jesus said, you know, he says, I like this. This is fun. I like the vampire, and I like the killer, and I like the, you know, he kind of liked this world. It seemed sort of fun to him. And, you know, I said, yeah, well, you know, hopefully it's fun. And I said, he said, well, you know, do you think you could shoot this in Luxembourg? And I had no idea really where Luxembourg was. I knew it was in Europe, but I said, yeah, sure. You know, we always dreamed of going to some place for us guys from Toronto, thinking anywhere is exotic outside of Toronto. So he brought us to Luxembourg, and it was because of his embrace, really, that he provided the money, and with another company, and then some Canadians came in. So yeah, it was sort of a miracle that, like, I still am amazed that we actually made it, because if you took this script to the, you know, on the rounds around the places where you usually go to, nobody would say yes. They would go, this doesn't make any sense. Why is there a vampire? Why is there two guys that are look the same? Why isn't it, you know, horror or sci-fi? You know, why isn't it one or the other? You know, so I feel like really lucky that Jesus of Luxembourg came along.
Feel the pulse of the city. Feel the beat of the drum. Feel the bass blow your hair. In Las Vegas, live music delivers much more than sound. It's where music comes alive. With artists like Megan Thee Stallion, Maroon 5, Carrie Underwood, Shania Twain, Babyface, Lionel Richie, and many more. Every show is a playground for your senses. See the full summer lineup at visitlasvegas.com.
Some people like to deep clean every Saturday morning. I prefer to spend a few minutes every day keeping things fresh with Lysol. Lysol's all-purpose cleaner cleans and kills 99.9% of viruses and bacteria. It can be used on hard, non-porous surfaces like the kitchen, bathroom, and other areas in your home. Don't just clean, Lysol clean.
This Black Music Month, State Farm wants to take a moment to recognize the undeniable cultural influence of Black musicians, composers, singers, and songwriters. From folk music to rock and roll, jazz, and more, Black culture has shaped almost every genre of music that exists today. Join State Farm in celebrating this month and beyond. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
When you find a deal on your favorite thing in the McDonald's app and order it, does that technically count as online shopping? Save money with the app. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's, prices may vary.
But it's not just luck, Bruce. I mean, you're very accomplished. I'm sure you're good in the room. I mean, what do you really attribute this, the yeses to that you receive?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he, you know, people are, when people come together, they're checking each other out. And I did have to go to Luxembourg and pitch. I pitched the film fund there. There was like a panel of eight people that that I had to go before. They had to be there in person. And there was like a distributor and a journalist and a thing and a bureaucrat and a thing. And I, they asked me all those questions. And I remember walking out thinking, there is no way they're going to throw the switch. But there was one guy on the panel who seemed to be really amused by the whole thing. So I think it was because of this one champion and, of course, Jesus of Luxembourg that they that they said yes. Because if it wasn't for that, we would still be sitting here with a script in our hands wondering when we were going to make Dreamland. So it's sometimes, you know, films are often a very strange journey. And, you know, you come to the table or myself with some experience and, you know, people go, yeah, I think he can pull it off, or he's not going to freak out, or he's going to not scream and yell at people, and he's going to pick some good cast. And so, you know, I'm bringing something to the table. Anyway, but it, this one especially, for some reason, just felt like a little bit like a miracle that this was something that was never really supposed to happen in the rational world. And through a series of very fortunate circumstances, the film gods were definitely smiling and feeling a little frisky, I think. So they thought, let's let them do Dreamland.
So after that meeting in Luxembourg, was that pretty much it as far as the financial needs? Or did you have to bring more money in once you got that piece settled?
Well, that was kind of the rock, you know, because once we got that, and we found out like 2 days after we had this tribunal, right? It was pretty amazing. And so there's a producer from Vancouver, Amber Ripley, who is a very lovely and hardworking gal. So she pulled the Canadian side. And then there was another partner in Belgium, Sebastian Slens, and there's a company, Velvet Films. So between the three, and that gets, it starts to get kind of complex when it comes to budgets and tax credits and all this sort of counting, and it's quite sort of hellish for the producers. But, you know, it's how independent films are made. So, you know, you have to spend a certain amount in each place and cast people from different places. And, you know, it all works and it's done all the time. But, yeah, great people. And so this is why we shot a little bit in Belgium. Because some money came from there, and we did some of our editing in Toronto, and then we did some of our sound. So you kind of spread it around. But you realize, you know, when you go to a faraway place, for me going to Luxembourg, you know, you're the visitor. I'm not bringing my usual team with me or my people. So I'm sort of the guest there, and it was really fun to be in another land and working with other talent.
Did you bring any of your crew with you, or was it literally just you and the producers and the actors and everyone else was from Luxembourg?
I brought an AD friend, Keith White, who did a great job. Because they told me, they go through all their, you know, co-production stuff, and they go, well, you can bring one person with you. Like, you can pick a designer or a DP or somebody. And I thought, well, anybody that's a department key, like a creative key, they're going to have their people, and their people are really important to them. Like, a DP is going to want to have his focus puller and his thing. So I thought, well, why don't I just bring my AD, because he's one of the allies you have on a set, and we'll just get everybody else from there. So the producers presented us with different, a few different people for each department. And then I got to talk to them, and then we picked our people.
Forgive me for taking a step back, but the Canadian film industry does seem a little bit more akin to the European industry than to the United States film industry. I don't know if you have a different opinion. I'd love to hear it. But have you done a lot of co-productions, or are you receiving a lot of governmental support as you make projects throughout the years?
Well, in Canada, there's this thing called Telefilm, which is kind of like a culture bank. And so they are involved in developing scripts and different things. So you can, on occasion, get... It's fantastic, actually. I mean, you know, it's a bit of a rigmarole to do it, but you can raise money for a writer to write a first draft of a script. So it's kind of amazing. And then they will come in as investors in a film, sort of maybe to 30%, you know, but you've pretty much got to bring the other pieces to them. So in this case, we're like, well, we got Belgium, we got Luxembourg, and it was sort of a no-brainer for them. So it's an investment, and it's all very, you know, as business as can be with a bureaucratic sort of institution. So for an independent filmmaker, it's a really sort of an amazing place to be, because I know independent filmmakers in the States, they don't have that same support. It seems to be coming more from like sort of private foundations and uncles, and, you know, certain right. studios have their little indie sort of outfit, or there's other, you know, there's people like Christine Vachon in New York City. I don't know how she does it, or, you know, Ted Hope and these guys, they've done it for years. And, you know, they're using international money, I'm sure, you know, a lot of the times. I'm always curious when I see it, like a Jim Jarmusch film or a Richard Linklater film, and like, I wonder how that was put together. And often you'll see like, there's some money from Japan, or there's some French money, or there's some. So I do think, you know, I wouldn't necessarily consider myself an expert at all at sort of indie film financing. But I can say that as an independent filmmaker in Canada, there's, you know, everybody bitches and complains, but there's a pretty good support. You know, it's not like they'll just give it away, but, you know, there's arts councils, and there's some private money. Like, I've raised money privately out of Toronto from crazy millionaires / gangsters. I've, you know, raised money from English television stations and French distributors. You know, so every project is sort of different. But yes, in Canada, there is an effort to support the arts, because we sit beside the United States, which is like this giant entertainment behemoth. So there's a kind of a notion in the government's eyes that if we don't sort of nurture our own novelists, musicians, actors, talent, we'll just be American. And there's, I mean, nothing wrong with being an American, but when you're your own sort of thing, you want to have some of your own thing. So
you've had a lot of projects over the years, and I'm sure you've worked with like lots of different types of ways of getting the funding for these projects. Like you said, like, have you found that you're able to go back to some of the same people, like maybe 5 years, 10 years later to fund a new project? Or do you find that like your money's always coming from someplace new?
That's a good question. I mean, I think because you build up a track record, yes, you can go back to people, and not just the, maybe not just the investors themselves, but sometimes the producers that do that job. Like, that's the nice thing about sort of getting to a point where you've done a bunch of stuff. You've got relationships with people. It's really helpful if you've made a film that's made everybody really rich, then they're really excited when you come back with the new one. But if it's, you know, I've just made films that have kind of just, you know, they've kind of, none of them has made lots and lots of money, but, you know, they've played around. And so, yes, there is a bit of repeat business, but it's always, there's always a kind of a new element for some reason. It depends where it's being shot, or depends on the genre, it depends on who's in it, that there always seems to be at least, you know, a new player. But it sure is nice when you build on the relationships of your past. And, you know, I will always do that. I will always go back to whether it's a private investor or a distributor or somebody that's helped put up some money. Like, for instance, actually, Jesus of Luxembourg, good example. So we've gone back to him with a project, and he seems pretty excited about it. So it's like, yeah. So if, and then we, because now we know how we work together, and it's really, no, it's not easier, but it's, you know what you're dealing with. And maybe you save a little bit of time and nonsense, you know, because you know how to, you know, get drunk together, you know how to fight, you know how to be on set, you know how to solve problems. So it's, you're kind of a bit more like family, and it is really great. And that's why I think you do see certain partnerships that go on for years in a creative way, in a business way. I mean, that's, if you're lucky and you find that, it's, you want to hold on to that for sure.
So what drives you then, Bruce? First of all, I'd love to be on one of your sets, because you just seem like the most lovely human, but I would love to see like what got you into this business, what got you to start making films, and what causes you to keep going.
when I was a teenager, my uncle gave me this camera, and I remember like a little Super 8 camera. And I think the thing that sort of blew my mind with that, and I was like 15 at the time or something, is that it wasn't so much about what we were making or what we wanted to make or what, you know, because we just, at that age, you love movies, you love, you know, everybody does pretty much. But I guess what sort of made me kind of sit up and take notice is that if you had a camera in your hands, you could get people to do just about anything. And I thought that was a really interesting notion, because I was a terrible guitar player, and I probably, if I was better, I'd be in a some kind of terrible cover band touring up and down the East Coast. But there is something kind of magical about that, that the camera became the sort of passport to adventure. Like you could get people to dress up and do things. You could get into certain places by saying, hey, we're making this movie, and could we get into this empty stadium on a Sunday when nobody's there? Or, you know, get into this interesting building. So it really started me to think that this little box with a thing in it, like a little lens and a, like, that's a pretty magical little thing. Like it, and so that's the thing that fuels me, because it sure is fun. You know, people often say, what's your favorite part about, I must say I do enjoy the set. I do enjoy the kind of camaraderie and the socialness of it, and the you know, it's a social art. It's not a solitary art. It's a very much a collaborative process, and I think I enjoy that the most. And whether it's collaborating with the writer and then with the, you know, producer, and then on the set. So on the set, it's sort of like the full house. So probably, you know, I like the fact that filmmaking takes you places, you know, like it takes you on adventures. It takes you on trips. It takes you into people's hearts. It takes you into people's lives. I'm kind of like a scattershot guy. So I kind of like the many aspects of something rather than being the master of one thing about it. And then, you know, it's storytelling and it's people. And so I'm not quite sure. I don't know if I have like a big message for people, or I'm like a writer in that sense, or a great social sense of social justice, or a great sort of thing. But I am curious. And I do love, you know, a good tale. And I don't know. So it's probably about as much fun as you could have at any job. I mean, I just feel really blessed that, you know, you can get paid to do this. And, you know, it's hard work. Don't, you know, like it's 24/7 pretty much, but I love what I do, so I don't mind working.
What advice would you have to, you know, younger filmmakers, maybe those who've had like one or two features under their belt or just getting started in their career? Like, what advice do you have to them to like kind of end up making thing after thing after thing and having a sustainable career?
This is a very sneaky question, because both Ulrich and I are feature filmmakers with one or two features under our belts. So basically you're saying to us.
Right.
I would say story, story, story. I mean, you know, just lately, because I've never really been a writer. Like, I've always worked with writers, you know, my whole career, and I've had the writers on set. So I've had this real, you know, writers that were way better writers than I was. Lately, I've been doing some writing myself, and it's you know, it's really hard work and it's really great. But I think it's a great thing to do as a young filmmaker is to write. But because I've been writing, I've been kind of going back to all the storybooks, like The McKee and The Save the Cat and The Thing. Mm. And there's a great book by a guy named Alexander McKendrick, and I would recommend that as an inspirational thing. He was a British director that came to L.A. after the disaster of The Sweet Smell of Success. Not an artistic disaster, but a commercial disaster. And he taught at one of the California film schools. And this is kind of a collection of his his talks to the students. And they're really inspiring. But, you know, what it comes down to is story. Story, 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 story. And I can't stress that enough, that I think what I see is a lot of filmmakers, they're trying to be the singer-songwriters, partly because economics and partly because of this, because they don't seek out a writer, right? They write it themselves, which is fine. But I would say 80% of the time, the scripts are that's the thing that's most lacking in the production, is the script. It's this foundation. Everything else is easy after that. It's not, you know. So I couldn't stress enough that, you know, that if your writers have some people that you are tough editors that will fucking nail you to the, you know, just and really work that story. I can't tell you how many times I've been in an editing room trying to fix the third act because we didn't work it out at the script stage. And this is not the time you want to do that. So yeah. It is really, I can't, you know, any, that would be 1,000% advice is really. And then look at the chamber pieces. Look at the masters that make these films that are set in like a room, like Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean by Altman, or a bunch of Bergman films, Persona, two chicks on a, in a cabin, which is one of the greatest films ever made. My Dinner with Andre, two guys having dinner and a waiter. Like these are kind of things to look for inspiration, because the trap, a lot of young filmmakers, and I'm guilty of this too to this day, is there's 40 locations and there's 23 actors and there's this and there's that. So your wire is stretched really thin. And suddenly, you know, and unless you have just the most brilliant script in the world, it's your resources are so stretched, and then the thing maybe comes out a little flat, or it's not quite. So I think, and then, so yeah, and the last thing I would say is the relationship between the director and the producer is like a songwriting team. And, you know, traditionally it's a kind of, you know, in the popular media, it's a sort of looked upon sometimes as an adversarial relationship because one is the money and one is the creative, but that's sort of bullshit because producers are extremely creative people and directors should fucking pay some more attention to the time and the money and figure out what can be done with what we have. And it's that relationship that is the thing that's going to solve your production problems, and it's going to define your production. It's going to define how you shoot it, what you shoot it on, who's going to shoot it. So these are all, you know, if you're lucky to have these sort of mentor people that can sort of really push you on your script or find a writer. Like when I was starting out, I was writing. And finally my friend says, you know, you're a terrible writer. We were working on this film called Highway 61 about a guy that goes down to New Orleans anyway, chased by the devil. And he said, well, there's lots of good shit in it. There's a devil and there's a singing family and there's like New Orleans whores and there's this and, you know, but your structure is weak, you know, your characters are weak. You got a lot of good stuff in there, but there's no real sort of. And so I said, well, where, you know, this was, I'm in Toronto. I'm not in Los Angeles or any place where there's a tradition of storytelling and thing. So my friends, I said, well, where do I find a writer? I wasn't from an artistic family. I had no connection to anybody in the business. And he goes, go to the theater. I'm like, oh, okay. Because Toronto had a lot of little, you know, it's not like Cats or The Phantom, just a whole bunch of these little theater companies, right, of people doing crazy shit and beautiful stuff for like audiences of 25 people. But there was a lot of those places. So I found a couple of people that I still work with to this day that were like, huh, I get paid nothing to work in the theater. And if I worked on a film, I might get paid, you know, nothing plus 5% or something. And I get a little bit more in independent film. So I found these writers that were a kind of a godsend to me that took what I had written as a bunch of cool stuff. And within, it was like Christmas, I remember getting the thing back from them. And it was like, oh, I get it. Story, it goes back to story. And these were people from the theater. They had studied theater. They had studied plays. They were directors and writers. And it's a shocking, it's still shocking in the film business how many directors know nothing about acting and very little about story, you know? Because it's easy to get distracted and caught up in style and lenses and the business of it and the politics and casting. And so, yeah, I mean, for you guys, I mean, hey, if you ever want to send a script, and we do this thing sometimes, once a month, where we get eight writers around the table and everybody reads a script, the script, and all these writers talk about your script. So wow. It's like having a rough cut screening for your screenplay. And I tell you, like, after so many times in the editing room of like, fuck, the first act is just a piece of shit. It's like too long, or the thing. And it's like, we could have done this in the script stage, but we didn't. We could have rushed to production. We thought we were geniuses. This is going to be great. But we didn't get the hard news from showing our script to 15. You know, it's not easy to get somebody to read a script because nobody really wants to read a script. It's not a thing that you really want to do when you're kicking back on a Sunday. But I can't, you know, I don't know if you guys are writers. I mean, but if you are, that's amazing and that's great. I really encourage that. But I think there is a deep, deep structure and a deep, deep talent to writers, and a good writer on your team or as an editor can really bring a fucking lot to your project. And it's always a bit scary because then you don't want somebody to take it over or to change it or to make it their own morality. You want to protect, you know, what's eccentric about it. You know, like a Dreamland is a very eccentric thing, but we spent a lot of time in the sort of structure of it because it went through many incarnations in the script stage that, I mean, it still seems pretty crazy, but you should have seen the first draft.
Feel the pulse of the city. Feel the beat of the drum. Feel the bass blow your hair. In Las Vegas, live music delivers much more than sound. It's where music comes alive. With artists like Megan Thee Stallion, Maroon 5, Carrie Underwood, Shania Twain, Babyface, Lionel Richie, and many more. Every show is a playground for your senses. See the full summer lineup at visitlasvegas.com.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie. And fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
This Black Music Month, State Farm wants to take a moment to recognize the undeniable cultural influence of Black musicians, composers, singers, and songwriters. From folk music to rock and roll, jazz, and more, Black culture has shaped almost every genre of music that exists today. Join State Farm in celebrating this month and beyond. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
When you find a deal on your favorite thing in the McDonald's app and order it, does that technically count as online shopping? Save money with the app. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's, prices may vary.
So focus on story, find good writers, find good producers, and just make the best story you possibly can out of your movie. Don't worry about agents, managers, any of that stuff.
I mean, that comes and that's really great, but to me it's kind of like, and don't wait for permission either. I mean, when we started, we were, you know, there's a certain luck in sort of being outside the gates of Hollywood because we had fucking no idea. I'd never even know what an agent was or a movie star. I mean, you know, we would use people from the theater. And, you know, you start, you know, you want to go somewhere, but if you start and you're building a base, people will help you out. People want to see you win. People, because they had somebody help them out when they were starting out, you know? And there's nothing like the energy that you can bring, you two, as you're doing your next production, because you're just like, fuck, we've done a couple, and that's amazing. And now we're kind of on the bus. But the next one is probably the most important one of all, because for the first one or two, it's just make it. Just the fact that you finished it is a miracle. You know what I mean? And it doesn't matter if it's any good. It's just like people are impressed. They're like, wow, they said they were going to do it, and they fucking did it. That's amazing. And that's no easy feat. We both know how you know, what's involved and the crazy shit that you go through to kind of get to the end. But now that you've sort of done it a couple times, well, that's a sweet spot you're in. So really, now it's story time. Now it's like, okay, what can we, maybe we have something in the cooker. Maybe we find something. Maybe we adapt something. Maybe we remake something. Maybe we are inspired by an actor that we love. or a place that we love. You know, and if you want to send up one of your scripts to our writer's table, we'd be happy to, you know, include you virtually in our little gang. And I know that the writers
do
it once a month, and it's people, and there are people, you know, like there's a guy, Vincenzo Natale, and he, like, he directs episodes of, like, big TV shows, like one of Westworld, and he did just recently a film for Netflix called In the Tall Grass, which was like a Stephen King or son of King's thing. Like, he did this movie called Cube and another one. He's kind of a sci-fi guy, but he's like, so Vincenzo comes, and Adam Egoyne is another, you know, Toronto guy. We got to, you know, because of the fucking pandemic and stuff, we've all, but I think probably in June we'll get back to it. We don't really, you know, it's all fairly random what we pick in the scripts and stuff like that. But,
you know, participate would be incredible.
Or just come and you just, you know, yeah, no, it's, and it's just fun. You know, and the writers all walk away kind of inspired, and, you know, you just get a kind of a, because it's different that you're showing it to writers, you're not showing it to agents or actors or managers or producers yet. You're just kind of going, here's what we've got. Here's where we're at. These are all writers who are, some are more experienced than others, but the hope is that you can walk away with like, huh, like everybody seemed to think that the opening was killer and that this character is amazing, but they all seem to think that that other character was not, they didn't quite know what their function was, or, you know, like, they'll have a couple of things that you go, fuck, that helps so much. I'm glad you asked me about the kind of what would you say to people, because when I was starting out, I had no idea what a theme was. I had no idea what a kind of act 1, 2, 3, or the reason that things are the way they are. And it doesn't mean you have to do it like that, but if you know the kind of dramatic structural kind of rules, then you know, it's just going to help. It's just going to make you punch above your weight, and you're just going to slay it at the festivals and at the thing. Like, you just, there's nothing like, because in the end, you know, people don't give a shit if your film is $100 million or fucking $100, but if they feel moved by it, or they feel that somehow it's authentic, they'll embrace it, you know, and run with it.
And we could probably talk to you for 4 hours, but we have to get things wrapped up here. And we finish with final 5 questions, kind of how we started the conversation. So I'll go first. What's the first film you ever made, and how do you feel about it now?
First film I ever made was called Our Glorious Dead. It was a Super 8 40-minute film where zombies attack the high school and kill all the teachers. And I think it's the best thing I've ever made.
You're the only person we've talked to who likes the first thing that they've ever made. What's the best piece of filmmaking advice you've ever received?
If it's not about love, it's not worth doing. Quote from Norman Jewison, director of Rollerball, Moonstruck, Jesus Christ Superstar, Fiddler on the Roof. Russians are coming in the heat of the night. Yeah. So his was like, you know what? Do good work and the gold will follow. If you don't, you know, you have to love what you're doing. You can't do it for the money. You can't do it for the position. You can't do it for the status. It's like, it's just too much fucking work, and it just takes so much out of you. And I always thought that was great advice. Finish what you start. That's from my dad. That's always very handy.
Nice.
And the last piece of advice, I was curious about it for a long time, but Francis Ford Coppola was once asked that question, what advice would you give to a young filmmaker? And he said, have a family. And I thought that was great.
I love that. I don't know if you can hear my son like banging his head against the wall right outside my door.
There you go. You're on your way, girl.
Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
Yes, I think I would love to make a rock and roll Western one of these days.
Ooh. I want to see it.
So yeah, I don't know, goals. I don't know, to tell the truth, you know, to try to really not be full of shit, and really try to have a movie that really touches people and is something, it's about something true, you know? Mm. It's not just to do it. It's not just to say, hey, I made a movie and it's really fun. But if you could make a movie that actually you know, changes the world or changes somebody. That's a pretty remarkable feat.
If you could go back in time, what's the piece of advice you would give your younger self?
Story. That would be nice.
That's right. Yes.
And learn about actors, you know? I would be story and study acting.
And then lastly, is making movies hard?
It is hard, but if it was easy, everybody would do it. And it's hard, but it's pleasurable. You know, sometimes, you know, hard is not a bad thing. Hard is just hard. You know, to get through it to the other side, you feel proud and you feel accomplished because it is hard. It is fucking hard. And it is time and it is like insane. And it is a lifestyle and it is a sacrifice and it is a lot of these things. But if your aim is true, all the hard work, you know, pays off on occasion.
Where can we find you? Do you want to send anyone to specific websites or social media platforms, Bruce?
Well, as you can see, I can barely turn on the computer, so I don't really have social media. So one of these days I'll get around to having social media. So no, I don't know. Like, check out some of our movies that we've made in the past, Pontypool or This Movie Is Broken, or Hardcore Logo is a favorite of people. It's a rock and roll movie. So I would, you know, see, they're around.
And then everyone should, of course, see Dreamland right away, right?
Yes.
Get it on VOD.
Yeah, get high and go see Dreamland, you know?
Yes. After seeing it once, I think watching it high would be a great way to watch it again, because what a trip.
You know, I really appreciate you guys taking the time and talking to me and watching Dreamland and kind of doing what you're doing, putting it out there. That's awesome.
Oh, no, our pleasure.
Yeah,
and
thank you.
Thanks for the fantastic conversation and all the advice. It's very, very helpful, man, you know? And I know our listeners are going to get a lot out of it.
Great.
And now it is time for You're the Expert. You're the Expert. What the heck are you talking about, Ulrich? What is this segment? It is a segment where we get questions from all over. It's basically Eric is the one who cultivates these. So he gets them from filmmakers, he gets them from listeners, he gets them from himself, all over the place. And he basically picks ones that are ones he knows that we're the experts on, that we will have the definitive answer to these questions. So this is this week's question. We get to read these in advance, so we have, you know, check them out. I actually didn't read this one because I've been so busy, but here it is. Hi, all. I've been making films for the past few years. My network is growing and I'm getting some good paying jobs. Sometimes I'm a director. Sometimes I'm an AD. Sometimes I'm a camera op. I still have a 9-to-5, but one job gets in the way of another. When will I have a clear sign that I can quit my day job and just be a creative? Wow. Okay. Interesting question. Liz, what do you think?
There's no clear sign. You're going to have to take a leap of faith and it's going to be super scary. But I would say it's important to evaluate what's at risk. So like, do you have the independence? Like, are you supporting anyone else? Do you have what we call on the show like a fuck you fund? Like, do you have enough savings? Where if you don't get any jobs from like production for a few months up to like a year, are you going to become homeless? Like, do you have enough money to pay your rent if you aren't called for jobby jobs in the creative fields? So for me, it's about like making sure you set up a safety net for yourself financially. And then once you have that safety net for maybe like enough where if work dries up for 6 months to a year, you're still okay, then I think it's okay to make the leap. But I really start thinking about like whether, I mean, the game is so different if you're just taking care of yourself versus taking care of, you know, like your parents or children or a pet who has medical conditions. Like, all those things should factor in. And I wouldn't say you just make the leap willy-nilly or impulsively. You really have to think about like, can I sustain myself and others if no job shows up for me? Like, if the industry goes on strike for, you know, 6 months to a year, will I be okay? And if so, then I would say make that leap. All right.
Nice. I basically, well, first, there's a distinction for me here. You know, they say, when can I quit my day job and just be a creative? Well, I would say as an AD or a camera op, you're not really a creative necessarily. you're just
fair.
A crew person.
Well,
I mean, a creative person is like a director or even a DP, you know, who are like really making more creative decisions on a daily basis. which, you know, like, as a post-producer, this, like, that really struck to me because I'm like, I'm not really living my life as a creative right now. I'm, you know, living my day job as a logistical person, but I am working in the field of video production. So it's like, okay, you know, whatever.
I think it should be the jump to story, something related to storytelling, right?
Right. Well, or just, I guess they're just saying, like, jumping into filmmaking, you know, which, mm-hmm. like, is also important, too. Because I also had that moment in my life where, you know, I was working sales jobs and, you know, being a bouncer, you know, as like, how to pay the bills. And then I was also doing film stuff. And then at some point, I basically, I got a job on a movie and I just, like, didn't show up for work at my sales job. I was just like, I'm not coming in. Sorry, no 2 weeks. Maybe I'll be back. I'll let you guys know. Sorry. You know, this is just too, just the idea of being, working on a movie was just too important to, like, you know, give that up to, you know, whatever, make my lens crafters bosses happy, whatever, you know. For me, it's not only the things you said, which are all important, but it's like, do you see the path to financial stability within what you're doing? Like, are you getting enough jobs where you are paying bills with the work you're doing in the film work, you know? And, like, do you have a clear path to, like, being sustained for any amount of time? And I mean that, like, for my film job, it was like, you know, I have this job that was going to be for 6 weeks, you know, or whatever. And, you know, as a 23-year-old or whatever I was, like, that felt like a good enough bit of buffer to be like, F everything, I'll work for 6 weeks and I'll figure it out after that, you know, and I have enough money to pay rent for a couple months and, you know, I'm sure I'll find a job, you know, or my next thing. And it worked out. I think for everybody who are at different stages at your life, that's going to mean a different thing, you know? So I like what you said about, like, making sure that you are covered for a longer period of time if you're going to leave your job, so that you're covered. I've also, like, seen this work out in many different ways. Like, I had a friend, a previous guest of the show, Gavin Murray, who was working as an electric and a grip and a, you know, whatever, doing that kind of work for many years. And then one day, he was like, look, I want to be a cinematographer. Like, I do not want to be a gaffer. I do not want to be a key grip. Like, that is not what I'm trying to do with my life. I am just going to be a DP. And he basically just quit cold turkey. He was just like, screw it. I'm not taking any more gaffer jobs. I'm not taking any more key grip jobs. No electrician jobs. I'm only taking cinematographer jobs, period. And I know, like, there was definitely a transition period where it was pretty tough for him. But, like, now he is a full-time working cinematographer, and he has been for many, many years. He's shot multiple films, you know, and it's like, I think that kind of mentality is, it's like a mental thing. It's, like, so important just to decide, like, I am going to do this thing and that's all I'm going to do. And I don't care about, like, you know, how hard it's going to be for me. I'm just going to do that thing. And I think, like, if I had decided that for, like, filmmaking and being a director and working on narrative films, like, I would probably be able to figure that out, you know? But, like, at this point in my life with the family and everything, it's just, I'm not willing to do that, you know? And I can't really do that to them, you know? Like, I can't, just because I would be willing to work hard and, you know, suffer a little bit, like, doesn't mean that my family should, you know? So, So yeah, I think it's a time in your life when you can make those decisions, but, like, yeah, I think it all has to be, like, calculated and you know, all brought in to, like, okay, when am I ready to make this leap? It's a very different answer for everybody. But yeah, just think about where you're at and what you can do and make that jump, man. Make it.
I was about to weigh in, and I hope that Jeff probably cuts this out, but, like, the way I see the world is, like, everyone's one medical emergency away from bankruptcy. Like, that's how I see the world. And it's, like, inserted into me by my financially neurotic sister. In the last episode, Clinton Cornwell is like, I'll just see what happens. You know, I sold all my belongings and I went to Europe and I just kind of moseyed around. It's like, I don't, like, that's such a romantic way of looking at the world. So I'm like, I'm in shock that people have enough faith in the system. It's very bold. It's very bold.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff, for cutting that out. All right.
I think you should include that, by the way. I think that's great.
Okay.
But, you know, whatever.
Jeff, keep it in. Keep it in, Jeff. Whatever. Everyone already knows I'm a nervous individual. All right. But anyone listening can always send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Freiman, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert California Jones for doing our social media. See you on the Zoom tomorrow with your son, Robert California Jones. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. Most importantly, thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to you all next week.
Do you know about all the musical genres that were created by Black musicians? Like jazz, rock and roll, and folk music, to name a few. This Black Music Month, State Farm is celebrating the cultural impact and influence of music created and inspired by Black innovators. Next time you're enjoying a song, trace it back to its origins and see for yourself. Check out the Black Music Forever station on Pandora, brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Feel the pulse of the city. Feel the beat of the drum. Feel the bass blow your hair. In Las Vegas, live music delivers much more than sound. It's where music comes alive. With artists like Megan Thee Stallion, Maroon 5, Carrie Underwood, Shania Twain, Babyface, Lionel Richie, and many more. Every show is a playground for your senses. See the full summer lineup at visitlasvegas.com.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie. And fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
When you find a deal on your favorite thing in the McDonald's app and order it, does that technically count as online shopping? Save money with the app. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's, prices may vary.